getting your tax forms right, and assessing your financial goals for the future. It is a snow day for many of us, a good day to hunker down and finally do your taxes. After all, the deadline is roughly a month away. But filing taxes can be daunting, even for people who've done their own taxes for years. After all, the tax code changes, as does one's personal situation. Maybe an elderly parent has moved in with you. Do you declare him or her as a dependent now? Perhaps you've left your job with plans to start your own business, or you are recently married or divorced. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will answer your tax questions and help you plan for the future. What better time to assess your financial situation than tax time? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If you happen to be snowed in today, it might be a good time to focus on your finances. Tax day rapidly approaches, after all. Well, today I have two guests who can offer advice and answers to your questions about money and taxes. With me in our studio, Joanne Bisson, who is president and CEO of Trademark Federal Credit Union. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Dewey Martin. He's a professor at Husson University and director of their School of Accounting. He's a certified public accountant, a certified management accountant, and a chartered global management accountant. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about your tax returns, credit scores? Do you have a personal finance tip to share? Please give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And welcome to both of you, especially on a day like this. I know it wasn't the easiest thing to get to work, or get to us in the studio, so I appreciate it. Joanne, I'm going to start with you. Do you advise people to take advantage of this time of year when they're kind of seeing these numbers laid out starkly in front of them to do their taxes as a good time to focus on longer term financial goals? Or do you say the opposite? It's all too much to try to tackle it all at once. What's your advice to the people who come into your credit union?
Well, this is a great time because you do have your mind is on it and you're moving forward to think about these longer term goals. And it can be very overwhelming. So in general, it could be overwhelming for someone, but take the time to use the resources you have by looking at the year-end statements that you have, to look over your expenses over the last couple of months, to start thinking about how could you manage those expenses better to help you in your longer-term goals.
So maybe a change of attitude instead of grumbling about having to do your taxes, seeing this as an opportunity to assess.
I think a positive attitude is always great when it comes to your finances.
Dewey, what kind of broad advice do you give folks this time of year as they start thinking about set aside and come back to their tax forms?
Well, I'd say that a critical point in success in the tax area is documentation. Make sure they keep adequate records of the things that might have an impact for tax purposes. I'm okay if I get to make that decision and they don't need to, but without the documents, we have a real struggle with the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay, so documentation, organization.
Very much.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, Joanne, what some really common mistakes people make with their personal finance, but I'm going to change that to ask you, what kind of missed opportunities do you most commonly see?
I think with missed opportunities, one would just be taking control of your finances. So a lot of times, I think people feel like it's out of their control, or they maybe don't even want to look at it because it's scary about what it might show. But when they do, they actually have a lot more power and freedom to move their finances in a better direction for them. So simple things like just looking at your statements to make sure the charges on them are your actual charges, that there aren't fees that you weren't expecting. Things like that would be a great first step.
Okay. And I'll ask you the same question, Dewey. What kind of mistakes do you see that are common specifically on your tax forms?
Well, I'd probably be more general than that, Jennifer, and say that from a planning perspective, a mistake that a lot of people make is they don't have in a marriage, both husband and wife aren't involved in the tax aspect of their lives. And that can be a real shock when one of them no longer is competent to handle the financial aspects of their marriage. So I would encourage people in a marriage to make sure both parties understand the financial situation that they're in, as well as the tax situation that they're in.
So both people sit down together and do your taxes and use that an opportunity to talk about finances in general.
I'd love that, yes.
Okay, I want to ask you, Dewey, about some specific things. I read this morning that the IRS says that only or one-fifth of eligible workers who qualify for the earned income tax credit don't claim it. So 20% of people who qualify are not claiming it. I'm wondering if you could explain to me what the earned income tax credit is and who qualifies and how to claim it.
Well, the key is the first word, the earned income tax credit. You don't get the earned income tax credit if you're, the money that you're living off comes from Social Security, your pensions. You actually have to have a job. And this is a tax benefit in the law that is a refundable credit, meaning you don't have to have any tax liability in order to get the credit. And it encourages you to actually go out and earn money in a job. The level of the credit that you get is increased up to a certain level of income and increased by the number of children you have, but then decreases as your income goes higher. It actually gets phased out and you don't get one. And I think the reason that a lot of people who are eligible for it don't claim it is because you have to file a tax return to get it. And there might be people whose income is too low to have a filing requirement, but not too low to actually get an earned income credit. It's a very significant benefit to taxpayers who are eligible for it.
So if you're somebody who has not been filing a tax return because you're so low income, but you are earning that money, will you receive a check in the mail if you qualify for it?
You have to file the tax return in order to get the credit.
Right.
If you file it.
Yeah. Will you get a check in the mail then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a refundable credit. And there's a provision in the law that allows you to collect it from your employer, like in your weekly paycheck in advance. Very few people ever apply for that, but it is a possibility. It would give you a better standard of living all during the year and not just at the end when you would get a check.
All right. Joanne, when you were talking about taking control, are you talking about budgeting?
Yes, I'm talking about budgeting.
And what do you mean by budgeting? I've read everything from it's good to have a budget, you know, a guide for you, to just keeping record of where you spend your money so you know.
So the first step in budgeting that I see is that you are keeping record of where you're spending your money to then determine, is that a good way of spending your money, where you're doing that. So what I would recommend is when you're starting your budget is to just track all of your expenses. And really, ultimately, you could use your debit card statements, credit cards, but anything you're spending in cash to try to keep those receipts. And then looking at that to say, all right, so is my income enough to support my expenses? Oh, and also with my expenses, is there a place that I could cut back? So really in that whole debate of, is that really a need or is it just a want? And so with that budget, by first going through and determining the wants and the needs and maybe putting together, I recommend putting together buckets of money like groceries, gas. So then throughout the month, you can track how much that you're spending. And it's pretty overwhelming. And most people don't have budgets because I think it's a hard way to start. But now there's so many ways you can do that on different apps at your financial institutions or even standalone apps that will help you track it on the go.
It can be really enlightening to realize
Yes.
how much you're spending. In my case, a few years ago, it was on groceries. I was really astonished. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're answering tax questions as well as personal finance questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start here with Chuck calling from Wyndham. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. So my question is, when your kids come back to live with you and dependents, how long can you claim them and as far as dependents go? So they move away and then they come back.
Dewey, could you hear that?
Yes, I believe I understand what he's asking. And there are two classifications in the federal law about dependency exemptions. And obviously, under the new Tax Cut Act that just passed, there are no more exemptions. But in terms of relating the question to 2017, there isn't really any time limitation. What happens if they move back with you is you have to look at their whether they've been in college or not. But you could claim a 30-year-old child or even someone who's not your child as your dependent if they have very little income. The income is the limit is about $4,000. But you could still claim if their income is less than that if you're providing more than half their support and providing a house for them to live in.
All right. Thank you, Chuck, for your call. I'm going to go to an email from Karen. Some people who retired here from Massachusetts and other states are being penalized by double taxation. They had put aside money from their jobs while they worked. This was supposed to enable them to not have to pay state income tax after they retired. But because they moved to Maine, this money is being ignored and they have no way to get access to it. Every year, they have to pay Maine income tax. The result is double taxation on people who really do not need this burden. I will again ask my legislators in the State House to sponsor a bill to stop this. Any other suggestions? Dewey, is this something you're familiar with?
Well, I'm not sure that it's... each taxpayer has to look at the tax laws in the state where they live, and I'm not all that comfortable with saying that Massachusetts taxes that income. If you earn a pension in Maine and then you move to some other state, Maine does not tax the pension that you receive while you're in that other state. I'm not sure if Mass does that or not, but even if they do, when you file your Maine tax return, you're entitled to a credit for the tax that you paid to Massachusetts on that income, up to the amount of Mass tax that you paid. So there should not be any double taxation in terms of a pure income tax perspective.
Interesting. Here's an email from Pam. Can you talk about the tax implications of selling a vacation or second home used as a rental? When it sells, how do you compute your tax obligations?
Well, used as a rental makes a big difference. If it's not a rental, a loss isn't deductible and a gain is taxable. But if it's used as a rental, the gain or loss impacts your taxable income. The calculation of the gain or loss is your total investment in the property minus any depreciation claimed on the property while it was rental property. That gives you your basis. Compare that to the selling price minus any selling expenses. That gives you your gain or loss. And most of the time, that's going to be taxed at capital gains rates, which are favorable if it's been held for more than a year.
All right. Joanne, I want to bring you into the conversation. This is the time of year when people can make a donation or a contribution to either a nonprofit or their IRA or 401k and help themselves as far as their tax bill. Do you think that's a good idea to be doing that in March or April of 2018?
Absolutely. It's a great idea to start using some of those tax benefits. And also when people, I think, when they're talking about getting tax returns, I hear people talking about vacations and being excited about how they might spend that money. They also might want to think about paying down debt or saving some of that money for unexpected expenses that come up throughout the year.
What is the general rule about when to pay off what debt, how to prioritize it?
So I think, you know, pretty much my first thought is you want to have an emergency fund because a lot of people don't prepare for the unexpected. So when something happens, they end up going to the credit cards or not being able to cover that. So I would first say put together an emergency fund of something about $1,000, let's say. And then after that, use that money that you put away to do that fund to start paying down debt. And you can do it a couple ways. Sometimes people do it with the smallest balance because it's mentally feels good to get this, you know, to get one out of the way. And some others start with the highest interest rate because that's going to be saving them money over the long run.
And one thing to keep an eye on right now is some of those variable interest loans, say you had a home equity loan, may be inching up now.
Yes, if it is tied to the prime rate or other variable rates like that, it would be inching up.
So maybe reassess what your loans are and what you're being charged for them in interest.
Exactly. And sometimes you're able to refinance those into fixed-term loans.
All right. We have an email from Carrie. My hobby has started to generate income. I'm planning on declaring what I made in 2017 as miscellaneous income on my 1040. I'm also planning to register my business as an LLC this year. Can I declare expenses, i.e. supplies, travel, studio construction, from the last 3 to 5 years on my 2018 return, or only expenses from that particular filing year?
complicated answer. If they were expenses before you had any revenue at all, then you might be able to claim them as pre-opening expenses. From the description of the email, I think probably it was a hobby in prior years, so those expenses do not carry forward. Most individuals are cash basis taxpayers, so all you could deduct in 2017's tax return would be the expenses that you actually paid during 2017, and that would be reported on a Schedule C on an individual's tax return.
Okay, so we don't know what Carrie's hobby is, but let's say she were a photographer and she built herself a darkroom a couple years ago as a hobby, but now decided to do it professionally. She cannot write off the darkroom expenses.
She can't write them off as ordinary expenses, but she does have a depreciable asset there. So it could be depreciated. You can stop depreciating long-lived assets in the period in which you put it into use. So it's not really considered to be a prior year expense if she's putting it to use in her business. In 2017, she can start depreciating those assets. The same if she's a photographer, the same for her camera and other equipment she might have purchased in prior years, but not the supplies like film.
Okay.
That kind of thing she would have lost the deduction for.
Okay. We'll go to Tanner, who's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Tanner. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Go ahead.
So my question is, I was wondering how to file for or how to report cryptocurrency gains or losses.
Dewey, that sounds like a question for you.
The IRS has fairly recently issued a revenue ruling that says that cryptocurrency is like any other investment. And if you invest in cryptocurrency and you make income on it because the value of it goes up and you dispose of it, it's taxable as a gain on your tax return. And losses would be capital losses. If you lost money on the cryptocurrency. So it's just treated just like you bought equities in the stock market.
Interesting. Cryptocurrency, again, being money that's not the kind of money we've been using for our whole lifetimes. It's the Bitcoin and those other. We've done main calling discussions about cryptocurrency. I think that a very small percentage of the population is involved in it, but those who some people have a lot of money invested in it.
They do. And really, right now, it's very speculative. So, you know, it's not something that I would recommend putting your money in as an investment, especially if you're looking to for something for retirement at this point. But I think one of the cool things about the cryptocurrency is the technology that it's built off of, which is blockchain, and how that might change not only the financial services, but how we do other things in other forms of business.
All right. Well, we are talking about personal finance, doing your taxes, tying it all together. This is a great day to finally hunker down and do some numbers, some personal finance numbers. If you have questions, we have experts here. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future.
The ads you see on Twitter might be based on the emojis you used in your posts.
If someone puts a thumbs up or a smiley face, then show them this ad. If they do a frowny face or a thumbs down, show them a different ad.
I'm Molly Wood. Emojis and how they're changing the way companies advertise. Next time on Marketplace.
Coming up this evening at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with investigative journalists Michael Isakoff and David Korn, author of the new book Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. They've both broken key stories about Trump and the Trump campaign's ties with Russia. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answers to your personal finance and tax questions. In the studio with me, Joanne Bisson, who is president and CEO of Trademark Federal Credit Union. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Dewey Martin, a professor at Husson University and director of their School of Accounting. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Dewey, I want to ask you, since you get to work with younger people, how prepared is the generation that's coming into adulthood right now for their own personal finance future? Do you find this generation more savvy than their parents or in a different place?
No, I don't, because I don't think they pay a whole lot of attention to the financial details in their lives. I've come to believe that every probably college graduate, maybe even high school graduate, should have a course in personal finance. They don't know a lot about insurance, whether it's life or health or disability insurance. They don't know much about credit ratings and credit scores for themselves personally and how important that is in their individual lives. And I find that most of them don't even reconcile their bank accounts today. They call Joanne and ask what the balance is in their bank account, and they believe that that's the right answer. And it doesn't take into account checks that have been written or deposits that may not be recorded yet. So, no, I don't think they're in great shape with regard to their own personal finances any more than they were 30 years ago.
Oh, gosh. And you're an accounting professor, so that's particularly discouraging. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And Joanne, you were nodding as he was talking. You're finding this among your clients, that people don't have a good sense of their own finances.
You know, that is different. You know, the people aren't bringing a checkbook and writing down every transaction that they do each time that they purchase something. Instead, they're just going by, as Dewey said, the balance that's appearing in their account. As part of working at a credit union and being part of the Credit Union League, we put on financial fitness fairs for high schoolers. And because in the school, they're not having that programming. And last year, we were able to get in front of over 7,000 high school students at over 35 fairs. And it was really great, and to see them understanding, because they basically work out a budget, to see, oh, I can't get that really expensive car. I have to get something a little more modest, or maybe take public transportation to reach the other goals that I have. And having them make decisions, I think it's a great exercise.
It's really hard in our consumer culture. We all want those things that we see advertised, whether it's the nice car or the nice television set or just a cute pair of sneakers.
You know? It's true. And I think if when you're thinking about budgeting and long-term goals, it's really important not to want to keep up with the Joneses and really worry about all sorts of things and really live within the means or below the means that you have so that you can prepare for a better future.
We'll go to Joy, who's calling from Raymond. Hi, Joy. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question in regards to credit reporting services. How secure are they? Which one should I use? Should I use all three, and how often?
That's a good question, Joanne.
Thanks. So what you can do every year is go to annualcreditreport.com, and you can look at a free copy of all three of your credit reports. And basically that's a great way to make sure that the information on the credit report is yours and you can see how it's reported. And a great recommendation that I've heard and I've used as well is that I look at each of the three reports every 4 months. So throughout the year, I'm looking at a free credit report to check on the status of my credit. And one thing when you're talking about credit monitoring services, those do have a monthly cost associated with them. And in some cases, they could be really beneficial. In the state of Maine, you actually have the ability to freeze and unfreeze your credit reports at no cost to you. So that's actually a great way to make sure that nothing unauthorized gets on your credit report, because in order for something to be able to be approved, you have to lift that freeze.
Yeah, and the information about that is the Maine Bureau for Consumer, I think it's Consumer Protection, but we'll post that on our Facebook page after this program. Thank you, Joy, for calling in. We'll go to Jeff in Littleton. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about select term life insurance. And my question is, on this plan, it's a select term 20, it's called. So it's good for 20 years. And if I outlive that plan in that 20 years, that money is actually reimbursed back to me. Is that taxable income? And I'll take my the comment off here. Thanks.
Dewey, do you know the answer?
Well, I can tell you the answer with regard to life insurance policies. I'm not familiar with the term, select term, but any life insurance policy that gives you money back if you cancel a policy is only taxable to the extent that the money you receive back exceeds the premiums that you paid over your lifetime, as long as you've had the policy. The way he's described it, he's receiving back what he's put in, so there wouldn't be any taxable income. If he receives anything in excess of those premiums, maybe in the form of investment income, that would be taxed.
All right. We'll go on to Kelsey from Moultonboro, New Hampshire. Hi, Kelsey. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks, guys. I love the show. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a young graduate, and I have an excessive amount of student debt. I don't pay the minimum. I pay a little more than that, but I don't kill myself to pay my loans every month. I have a lot of friends and even my sister who pay tons of money every month because they want their student debt gone. And in my head, I'm like, I'm not going to kill myself to pay it off. Someday I'll have a good job that can pay all my debt at once. And I don't know if that's the right way to think about it, but I just see everyone around me so bogged down by student debt and they just want to pay it, but then they're not enjoying their life. And I'm like, what if you die tomorrow? You know, you didn't get to enjoy anything. You just paid all this debt.
Joanne, a really important question right now because so many young people are coming out of college with debt. Do I just pay the minimum and keep paying it until I have a better paying job, or do I stretch and try to pay as much as I can every month?
Well, and that is a really good question, and it's kind of like, you know, you're working hard, so you want to have something to show for it. And I think when you have those balances, it's easier now to make the choices that are harder and to whittle away at that debt than having to change your behaviors later on. And, you know, if you do think that in there is a time frame where you see, okay, I will be making more money, then it may make sense to alleviate some of that stress now. But also at that time, sometimes when you're making more money, there's also more other things that need to be, you might be considering saving for a home or something else at that point. But one of the great things about having other people around you that are going through the same thing is you guys can encourage each other to work that plan together. So instead of maybe doing something that costs more money by going out, you can all, because you have the same goals of paying down that debt, you know, stay in and have the same fun experience with the same people versus maybe going out and spending money that way.
All right. Well, good luck, Kelsey, to you. And thanks for calling into the program today. Let's see. We've got lots of things coming in by tweet and email. Here's a tweet. Can Dewey talk about how, if at all, the changes to the tax law enacted recently do or don't impact this year's tax filing?
There aren't many changes that affect the 2017 returns. Some of the changes in the tax bill that was finally enacted that Susan Collins convinced Washington to include, like reducing the reduction of your medical expenses back to the 7.5% range, that has an impact. But there aren't many changes that impact 17. They didn't change things that already were in existence that they had talked about changing in the course of looking at tax reform, things like the educator expenses for $250. There are a lot of proposals to do away with that, but they didn't. I would like to go back, though, to a topic we talked about briefly earlier, and that is
sure.
The home equity loan, because one of the changes in the tax bill was to do away with home equity loan interest starting 1/1/18 if the home equity loan wasn't used for improvements or renovations or expansion of your home. So, for example, if you took out a home equity loan to buy your new car because the interest would have been deductible, it's not going to be deductible in 18. So Joanne mentioned refinancing maybe to get a fixed rate on the loan. You also might want to refinance your home equity loan if you're not going to get a deduction for the interest in order to put it into a fixed mortgage and get that deduction. And that's something you'd have to do now to have any impact on your interest expense.
So, Dewey, if 2 or 3 years ago you took out your home equity loan to actually make an improvement on your house, maybe replace the roof or fix up a bathroom or something, do you now need to go back and find receipts for that to justify that deduction in the future?
Well, the IRS has to issue rulings on how they're going to deal with it, but I sincerely doubt that they will require that in order to document it. Obviously, that's up to each individual taxpayer to deal with their own conscience, but I wouldn't suggest to my clients that they worry about going back unless they get audited and are asked for that documentation. Sticky wicket for the IRS, no question.
So if you sincerely did use your home equity line to fix up your home, you may continue to deduct that in the future.
Yes, and I wouldn't worry about documenting what you spent the money on now. I'd only worry about being honest now, and then if you get audited, worry about the substantiation at that point. You ought to keep your records for 4 years at least, but if you spent money for improvements on your home, I recommend that you keep those records until you dispose of the home.
Interesting. Okay, a tweet from Deanna. What questions should we ask ourselves when we're looking for a financial advisor or planner to help with big questions regarding investments, savings, taxes, and college funds? What kind of advisor do we need?
So with a financial advisor, you know, I think first is asking for recommendations. Ask for people that have the same questions you do. Who are they using? And going through and making sure that you're interviewing them like you would or researching like you would for anything else in your life. Make sure that they're licensed for what it is that you're looking for them to do. And also understand how the payment arrangement is, if it's by hour or if it's about the investments that they're going to manage for you. So that would be how I would start going about it. And when you meet with them, do they listen to you? Do they understand what your goals are and your needs? And do you have that chemistry? Because this is a person that, you know, you'll be working closely on what your goals are and how to attain them.
We have an email from Mal. I'm a private music instructor, and I'm wondering what classifies as depreciable or as office expense. For example, if I buy music books or teaching materials that will be used over a long period of time, are they depreciable even though they're relatively small individual expenses?
No, you could classify those as expenses and deduct them in the year that you spend the money. The IRS looks to long-lived assets, but they also there isn't any de minimis rule in writing for supplies like that, but they wouldn't care. If you adopted a policy of expensing everything like that that cost under maybe $100 or something like that, you wouldn't have any problem with it.
All right. An email from Marie. What financial/budgeting advice do you have for couples who are moving in together but not officially married?
So I guess the question is if you're going to be mingling your finances or not at this point. And say let's say that you're not, you may want to have a shared account so that you can account for these expenses that are combined, so like rent or electricity. But I think it's really important that as you're making those steps that you have the conversations about how the expenses are going to be split up, how they're going to be managed, and overall what your philosophies are on spending and saving.
All right. And I'm going to follow up with that, Dewey. I understand that for some married couples, it's a good idea to file jointly, and some it's a good idea not to. How do you figure out which you are?
Well, for the most part today under the tax law, filing joint is going to be to your advantage rather than being married filing separately. There are some parts of the law that actually take away huge amounts of deductions and credits if you file separately. The only real reason to file separately is if you're getting divorced maybe, or for some reason you don't trust your spouse, you think your spouse has illegal income, then you absolutely shouldn't sign a tax return with that person because the IRS says you're joint and severally liable for all the taxes on that illegal income, except for some special circumstances. If I could back up a second to the moving in but not getting married issue, you have to keep in mind that the person who can deduct, for example, the mortgage interest on the home, if these people are going to live in a home with a mortgage or the real estate taxes, the only person who can deduct it is the person who actually has the liability, so your name has to be on the mortgage or in the title to the property, and actually makes the payment. So you can pay it out of a joint account, but that complicates the issue. And if the person's name isn't on the mortgage, but they're contributing to the joint account, they're not going to be able to deduct the mortgage interest. So that's a very sticky situation tax-wise to be in. Not so bad for rental property.
Right.
Interesting. An email from Corrine. Why take risk to yield 4% minus 1% broker's fee? We don't trust capitalism's cyclical boom-bust cycle. Would like to invest in low-income real estate investment trusts, but don't know how to vet them. Did pay off our mortgage. Ideas?
I'm not really sure on that one.
I would say that if you're that conservative, that I don't think necessarily a REIT is a great idea. As we saw in 2008 through probably 12, real estate values do substantially decline sometimes. not historically over 50 years, but over that short period of time. So I would say that you ought to think about something different than a REIT if what you're after is a more conservative investment.
Cindy on Facebook asks, we have a financial advisor manage one of our 401k accounts. Should we move that money to an index fund, and how do we go about doing that? This is a great question. I think a lot of people have started to move money into index funds that really aren't managed by a personal investment advisor. What are your thoughts, Joanne?
My thought is that really I'd recommend getting that one-on-one advice with your financial advisor or a different advisor for that. I'm not really that versed in the investment arena.
Okay. We'll go to Saul. My daughter's college issued the 1098 form for the four school calendar years, 2013 through 2016, whereas we are making tuition payments which spanned 5 years. Why aren't those two reconciled? Having paid January 2017 tuition for my daughter's last semester, I'm not eligible for any tax credits for 2017 and can only take the less favorable tuition tax deduction. So before you answer his question, Dewey, I want you to explain his question to us.
Well, when Congress put into the tax law the American Opportunity Credit, different name before, but now called the American Opportunity Credit, they really wrote the law in a way that was very confusing to taxpayers in that they said that you could only claim the credit in 4 years, when virtually everybody knows that a college education takes place over 5 calendar years. So the colleges didn't help a lot because the rules regarding generating the 1098-T weren't very clear either. I always recommend it to my clients, if you want to make sure you get this right, get a copy of your accounts receivable bill from the university for the whole year, and then you can see what the charges actually were during the calendar year and what the scholarships or other payments were that were applied to that. Congress has fixed that and changed it to be 5 years of 4 years of education spanning 5 years. But I apologize for not knowing the effective date of that. I can't remember if it's in the tax cut bill or if it's in a revenue ruling or what it is. So I'm not sure when that's effective, but they have changed that problem. They fixed it.
Okay. Well, Saul, thank you for that interesting email. We do have to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to break, though, tell you about tomorrow's program. We're going to be discussing school security. If you have comments or questions to email us in advance, go ahead and do so. talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do University of New England, with info sessions and tours for healthcare degree programs, une.edu/health. And Nancy Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences.
On Wednesday morning, students across the country will walk out of class.
It's about protesting Congress's inaction when it comes to gun violence.
That raises legal questions about how schools handle the situation.
Is it going to be disruptive to the learning and educational mission of the school?
I'm Ari Shapiro, protesting at school this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up shortly at 2 o'clock, it's our public affairs program, The Anatomy of Tyranny. Yale Professor Timothy Snyder, author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Again, coming up shortly at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, personal finance and tax questions. Joining me, Joanne Bisson, President and CEO of Trademark Federal Credit Union. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Dewey Martin, who's a professor at Husson University and director of Husson's School of Accounting. He's a certified public accountant, management accountant, and global management accountant. We invite you to be part of our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Lynn. Yesterday, I was helping my son with his taxes, and I was shocked to learn that his refund was so huge, ostensibly because he contributed to a 401k plan and Roth IRA. Does that sound right to you? Did we perhaps make a mistake? He works in retail, only made about $17,000 last year, and contributed $609 to his Roth and $406 to his 401k. When you hear that, Dewey, do you think maybe that his he needs to have less taken out of his paycheck each week?
I think it's wonderful. At a very young age, he's saving for his own retirement, and I'm a huge fan of Roth IRAs for young people. But in answer to her question, the Roth IRA isn't tax deductible on his return anyway, so that's not increasing his refund. And that amount of contribution to the 401k, it saves him taxes. I certainly encourage him to do so. It doesn't have a huge impact on the amount of his refund, maybe $100, depending on his tax bracket.
Okay.
So that's probably not why. It's probably the amount of his withholdings on his pay that caused him to have the really extreme refund.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people, Dewey, are always trying to adjust their withholdings so that they come out even at the end of the year. But it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, especially now where we have major tax reform affecting everybody in 2018 and affecting everybody in Maine, too. I mean, in Maine, it's scary. If you don't adjust your withholdings right now and Maine doesn't enact any tax changes, then there's going to be a huge increase in people's liabilities. For my clients so far, 90% of the returns that I've filed will have lower federal taxes in 2018, and 100% of them will have higher Maine taxes if Maine legislature doesn't do anything.
And the higher Maine taxes, that predominantly because state and local taxes will not be able to be deducted in full for many people?
That affects the federal taxes, but it doesn't affect your Maine taxes. No, the principal reason is that Maine tax law looks to federal tax law for the dependency exemptions claimed and personal exemptions on the federal return. Well, in 2018, there won't be any of those. So that's $4,000 per person of additional taxable income in Maine. There's been legislation proposed to mitigate that somewhat, but I'm not sure how far it'll get in the legislature that has trouble getting along.
All right.
So people ought to be talking to their legislators.
Right, right. And, you know, and a lot of the conversation about tax conformity has really been about the inheritance tax, but you're talking about something else entirely.
And the inheritance tax increase is going to affect a very minimal number of people, probably less than 3% in the state of Maine, whereas this increase in the income tax, it's not going to be 100% of the taxpayers, but it's going to be a very large increase for a lot of taxpayers if our legislature doesn't do something.
We'll go to Michael calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering, can you use the home equity line of credit on one house you own to use to do renovations on another house you own and keep the deduction?
Yes, you can. The definition of qualified residence interest includes both the first home and a second home. So if you borrow on a line of credit on your first home to do renovations on the second one, it would be included as qualified residence interest. No problem there.
All right, Michael, good question. Thank you. Dana on Facebook asks, I have some savings that I keep in a checking account and that I'm not sure what to do with. Should I put part of it in an IRA? I'm also currently building a house with the help of a bank loan. Should I wait to put my savings in an IRA after the house is built?
So I think every situation's very different, and having money, but having money that's considered kind of extra or savings in your checking account is definitely, it usually has a less amount of interest that you're going to earn. So I would consider putting it somewhere else. If it's going to be something for retirement purposes, then an IRA can be a good vehicle for that. Or if it's a shorter term and you're not quite sure what to do with it, maybe you could put it into a certificate for like 6 months or a year, depending upon until you can figure out what you want to do with that long term.
All right. Dana, thanks for your question. We'll go to Elizabeth calling from Starks. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about doing my taxes. I work at a cooperative, and we get a 1099 PATR every year, which is our patronage dividend income. We actually get only 20% of our patronage dividend from the co-op, and they reserve 80% of it as working capital until we get to be a certain age. And a lot of us joke that pretty much the amount of the dividend pays for the taxes on that, you know, because we're responsible for paying the taxes on 100% of it. And we all do it a little differently, and some put it on a Schedule C or F because they don't know where else to put it, and that has a lot of taxation on those. And didn't know if you knew anything about those or a simple way to get those on the taxes and not just be taxed.
Yeah.
All
for it. Dewey, does this sound like something you're familiar with?
It is something I would want to research because I agree there's all kinds of confusion out there about the PATR dividends. I've read that they're not taxable at all, and I've read that they are 100% taxable, as she had mentioned. I would like to have the contact information so that I could get back to the caller.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth, if you can hang on just a second, we'll try to get that information from you. In the meantime, I'll go to this email from Dave. We hear most of our lives about saving for retirement. When and how is it recommended to use retirement savings so that we can enjoy life and keep money in reserve? Is there a rule of thumb or suggestion?
So he's asking about when they're in retirement?
Just right. And, you know, we've saved all our lives for retirement. Yeah. Now we're retired. How do we use that money? What's the rule of thumb to keep saving and how to use it?
So it really depends on what kind of lifestyle that you're looking to live, as well as, you know, what you have for savings. So one of the places that you could use for as a resource is going to you're going to the Department of Labor website, because what you can do there is do some calculators to see about what kind of income you have now, what you want to be spending and saving throughout your retirement. And that could help answer some of those questions when you're there. You could see, even thinking about what kind of goals you have during retirement, whether it's vacationing or, you know, buying a lake house.
All right. And we'll try to get that website and put it on our Facebook page after the program. Thanks for the question, Dave. We're going to go to another Elizabeth, this one calling from Ellsworth. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the income limits for IRAs, especially for Roth IRAs. I was really surprised a couple years ago when doing our taxes to realize that I had to take back what I'd put in my Roth IRA because we hit the income limit, and I never hear people talk about there even being one. And then what are good options for retirement savings if you're over the income limit for IRAs?
Dewey, do you have thoughts?
Well, it is true that there's an income limit for Roth IRAs. I'm not a big fan of non-deductible IRAs, but that may be your only choice here, which would mean that you don't get a deduction for the money going in. But you do pay tax on the investment income that you earn when you take it out, as opposed to a Roth where you don't get a deduction going in, but you don't pay a tax on anything when you take it out. Traditional IRA may be available if neither spouse is an active participant in a pension plan. Then there aren't income limits, so you might have a traditional IRA that would be deductible on the tax return, but probably not a Roth in this situation.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for your question. We have an email from Sarah. Could your guest please explain the different kinds of financial advisors? Brokers are not the same as advisors. Specifically, please explain the benefits of money managers that have a fiduciary responsibility to their clients.
So when I use my financial advisor, they're using for a couple different reasons. One is for my long-term retirement savings. And then also I can go to him and talk about how do I set my financial plan up. So there's definitely different reasons to even use the same person. And I'm not really sure what the caller, the differences that they had mentioned. I don't know if Dewey, you have an understanding of that.
Yeah, it depends on what services you're looking for. Virtually anybody can call themselves a financial advisor if they want, but you ought to be maybe Googling them to see what their credentials are. If you're after investment advice, then you might be looking to a stockbroker or somebody like that. But if you're looking for life insurance advice, you might be talking to somebody completely different. If somebody has a credential of a certified financial planner, then they would have the knowledge of all those different areas in order to be certified. So it depends on what the taxpayer is really looking for in terms of advice.
We'll go to Margaret calling from Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, my tax strategy is to try to keep my income below a taxable limit. And my strategy in the past has been to donate at least 50% of my income, which is the limit in the past that has been allowable as a deduction. But then early on, before they passed the tax bill, there was a lot of discussion about what might be in it and what might not. One of the things that scared me was that they were considering dropping tax deductions for charitable donations. And and then after the tax bill was passed, I never heard any word at any point about whether it was included in that or whether they didn't do that. And I just talked to a tax person and found out that not only is it still included, but that you can deduct up to 60% of your income in terms of donations.
Well, Margaret, you know, what a generous person you are. And Dewey, is that your understanding as well, that now people can donate up to 60% of their income in charitable donations?
Yes, that was a change in the law.
Yeah?
Yes. I would be a little bit careful because of the increase in the standard deduction. Depending on the level of income and the level of contribution you're talking about, it may be to your advantage to claim a standard deduction in 1 year, but double your charitable contributions in a second year, because otherwise, depending on the levels, you may not be getting any tax savings out of the contribution. That may not be the only reason you're making it, obviously, but you need to look at your standard deduction, your itemized deductions, to see if you're getting a tax benefit.
Is there a way, is there a calculator online or something that somebody can go to, Dewey, and figure this out?
I'm not aware of one. There probably is one. The financial planning websites have been really good about developing software like this. I'm just really cautious about recommending things like that because the tax law is so complicated. And everybody's tax situation is so different. I'd rather talk to them personally.
Yeah. I have an email. My ex-husband is claiming our son this year is dependent on his taxes per our divorce decree. Our son lives with me at least 80% of the time. Can I claim my son for head of household status if my ex-husband does not claim head of household?
No, you have to be able to claim the child as a dependent. But understand, but this is a little complicated, but the Internal Revenue Code says that the parent who can claim the child as a dependent in a situation with divorced parents is the custodial parent, not defined by the divorce decree, but defined by where they live. If this child lives with the mother for 80% of the time, she's entitled under the law to claim that child as a dependent. Now, if she's not willing to fight that battle with her husband over it, then she cannot claim head of household status. And in some cases, this is a huge tax answer because of the earned income thrown in on top of that.
Mm.
So if there is a fight, and this does happen about who's claiming who, generally speaking, the first person to file has a significant advantage in that fight if they claim the dependent. So I'd say if you think there's a fight coming down the road, get your return in early.
All right. Well, that's one of the many reasons we're hearing to get your return in early, right, Dewey?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And on that note, it's going to be our final thought. I can't believe we're at the end of this hour. Thank you both so much for being here. You just heard from Dewey Martin, a professor at Husson University, director of Husson School of Accounting, and Joanne Bisson, president and CEO of Trademark Federal Credit Union. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. And for those of you who are musically inclined, don't forget about our contest to come up with a new Maine Calling theme. Visit our website for more information. Tomorrow on the program, a look at school security. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.